I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Welcome back to Radio Times. Backyard gardeners are enjoying the fruits of their labors, harvesting warm or hot weather crops like peppers and squash and tomatoes. What to do with all that bounty? Well, you could share it with your neighbors and coworkers, and they will thank you for it. You can also do something that your parents and grandparents did, preserve those fruits and vegetables through canning and pickling, freezing and drying. Well, today on Radio Times, the why and how, the do's and don'ts of preserving and storing food, and we have two guests who have joined us. Here in our Philadelphia studios is Marisa McClellan. She's a writer, a canner behind the Food in Jars blog and book. She also teaches canning classes around Philadelphia, including one tomorrow at Greensgrove Farm in Kensington. And Marisa, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you. It's nice to be here.
Nice to have you here. Also with us and joining us by telephone is Sharon Astick. She's a writer, teacher, blogger, and farmer. In fact, she and her family live on a farm and work on a farm in rural upstate New York. They raise vegetables, pasture poultry, and dairy goats at Gleanings Farm, a 27-acre homestead, and joins us on Radio Times as well. And Sharon, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thanks so much for having me.
You're welcome. Marisa, let me begin with you. I know you've been canning for about the last 6 years. What do you think explains, I would say, a resurgence, an interest in canning as our parents and grandparents did?
Well, I think there are a number of factors that play into the resurgence of canning right now. I think the economy plays a role. People are trying to save some money. The locavore movement has really helped the canning movement come into its own, because here in the Philadelphia area, if you want to eat locally and you want to eat fruit in January, you have to do some sort of preservation. Mm-hmm. I think also people are really disconnected from their food. They've lost that sense that, you know, they can take a raw ingredient and turn it into something that it will last more than a meal. So I think there are a number of factors.
What do you think, Sharon?
I agree with Marisa, and I think one of the other things is that there's this sort of general sense of insecurity, economic insecurity and social insecurity, that, you know, maybe things don't feel very stable, and the full pantry is a measure of stability and a measure of security. And, of course, the other thing is that what you make yourself often tastes much better than anything we can afford to buy.
And how full is your pantry, Sharon?
Well, I have, at the moment, you know, we're parents and foster parents. I have six little boys in my house, so I try to preserve it as fast as they eat it, but it's an ongoing exercise.
How did you get interested, Marisa, in canning?
I grew up canning. I grew up in Southern California and Oregon, where stuff just grows. You know, we always had plum trees or apple trees, and, you know, Oregon, the blackberry brambles are something of a scourge, but you always have access to fresh wild blackberries. And so my mom and I would can. Not a lot, you know. We were always fairly urban, suburban, but, you know, we'd make enough jam and applesauce to last a year. And so it was something I always knew how to do. And then about 6 or 7 years ago, I went blueberry picking with a friend in New Jersey, and I came home with 13 pounds of blueberries. And I was like, what do you do with 13 pounds of blueberries? You make jam. So I called my mom, I bought some jars, and I started making jam. And there was just something about it that stuck. It was so satisfying, and I kept doing it.
And looking at your book, it looks like your jams, jellies, marmalades, chutneys, that seems to be your area of interest.
Yeah, you know, the water bath canning mostly. I do some pressure canning on my own, which is a whole other kind of, it's canning 201, if you think of water bath canning as canning 101. But for what I tell people, teach, and, you know, write about, it's the easier stuff.
I do want to pick up on that. But Sharon, let me go back to you. And I'm interested in this homestead, this 27-acre farm that you have. Do you largely live off of what you grow there?
Yes and no. We produce a lot of what we eat. In the summer, we certainly produce the vast majority of what we do, everything from milk and eggs and meat to vegetables and fruit. But we also depend on the same, you know, sources that other people do. We go to farmers markets. There are things that I don't grow, and every year we have a bad year for something,
right.
You know. So we depend on, you know, outside cycles as well. So.
And how did you get interested in this, this lifestyle, if I can call it that?
You know, I don't know where it came from. It was one of those things where somewhere, I certainly have farms in my family background, but they're fairly distant. And one day I woke up, and, you know, I'd always had a little garden. You know, my stepmother made jam, you know, periodically, but one of these days I woke up and I was pregnant, and I'm thinking, you know, I really want to know where my kids' food comes from, and I want to have a bigger role in this, and I feel out of control of some things, and somehow we ended up living on a farm, which is sort of crazy, because we really had no skill set, you know, my husband and I were both academics, and we picked up and moved to the farm, and it turned out that you can do crazy things, and, you know, God protects, you know, children and idiots.
Well, lucky you, I guess. I'm looking at your list of, and your book is both about storage and about preserving, but some of the things that you store: 10 pounds of black beans, 10 gallons of local honey, 5 gallons of local maple syrup, 50 pounds of onions, 20 pounds of sugar. So you have a big pantry filled with food.
We do, and I mean, it varies from year to year. Like, I don't have 50 pounds of onions right now because the onions are still in the green stage in the garden. But come October, there'll be much more than, actually, it probably will take about 300 pounds of onions to get a family of eight through the winter, believe it or not. We eat a lot of onions. And, you know, we do buy a lot of our food in bulk and store it, and because it's so much cheaper. And it also reduces packaging, so there's a lot less waste. And it allows me often to support farmers directly, to buy my beans, for example, from a farmer, you know, who grows them and who gets more money from me than if they have to sell to a middleman. You know, the average farmer in the United States only gets 7 cents out of every dollar.
And a lot of food goes to waste in this country as well. Sharon?
Absolutely. And, you know, that's one of the other things I love about food preservation, is that it's a way of reducing waste. First of all, you know, we all know about those gluts in the garden, you know, and what do you do besides throwing the tomatoes over the fence when you've eaten as many tomatoes as you could possibly hold? But there's also the other sort of sense that, you know, when you have small quantities of extra food sitting in your fridge, I have some overripe peaches right now, you know, and what am I going to do with them? Well, I can mix that with some of the plums that I have and make some peach plum jam. And the thing is, with good ingredient, fresh ingredients, there's not much you can do to go wrong. I mean, I've never made peach plum jam before, but I'm reasonably confident it will be good.
Fair enough. Maurice, let me go back to you. As you said, you use the water method for canning, and I think this will work on the radio, but what are some things that people should think about if they're considering canning?
Well, in terms of equipment, you don't need a lot of special equipment to can. As long as you have sort of a roomy stock pot and something to put in the bottom of it that can serve as a rack to protect the jars from the heat of your burner, you're pretty much good to go right there. So the water bath method is essentially where you heat up some jars and you make your product, whatever you're making, jams, pickles, whatever, and you take those hot jars and you place your product in them, you put on hot lids, you screw the bands down, and then you process for a prescribed amount of time. And processing simply means boiling those jars in this stock pot of yours. Jam typically gets boiled for 10 minutes. And what the boiling process does is that it both kills any bacteria that's in the jars, and then also it heats up the oxygen that's in the headspace of the jar, which makes the oxygen expand, which then it escapes from the jar while it's expanding. And so then when the jars come out of the canning pot and cool down, the space where the oxygen was kind of contracts and you get a vacuum, a really good airtight seal. So that's how the canning process works. And you really, it's not hard. I always tell people if you can boil up a big pot of pasta, you can can.
Is it time consuming though?
In the way that I do it, in sort of small batches, it's not. I mean, I can be in and out of a canning project in an hour or an hour and a half.
You want to add to that, Sharon? Do you have any special approaches to canning?
I really do. It's the same process wherever you're doing it. What I do find is that, you know, of course, the big expense in this is the jars, you know, getting the glass jars. And I do find it's great. They're a great thing to look for on Freecycle or Craigslist, you know, or to check out garage sales. You know, I just got 50 canning jars for $5 at a church rummage sale because there are a lot of people who, you know, just don't know that these have value, you know, and they can continue to be used.
And do you need a special jar?
You do need. You need a mason jar. Typically, they either say ball or Kerr on them. They're all the mason jars in the U.S. are typically made by the same company now. So ball and Kerr are owned by the same people. And so you want a jar that is that can hold the two-piece lid. Mm-hmm. So you have that flat lid and then the ring that holds it down. So you don't, because those jars are designed for canning and to handle the heat of the canning pot. And so you don't want to just can in any sort of leftover peanut butter jar or something like that.
Well, I'm thinking of someone listening and being concerned about contamination or botulism. Do you have to think about that, but do you have to worry about it, Marisa?
As long as you stick with the high acid foods. So when I say high acid, I mean jams and jellies and pickles and things like that, which have, you know, there are all these technicalities with canning and pH levels and things like that. But essentially, if you stick with a tested recipe and you stick with the higher acid foods, you don't have to worry about botulism, because botulism spores cannot develop into the full-grown botulism toxin in high acid environments. So it's not a concern.
Do you add lemon? I mean, in terms of keeping that acid level up?
You can add lemon to things that are sort of in the gray zone as far as acidity. So, for instance, tomatoes in recent years have been bred to be less acidic than they once were. And so our modern tomato needs to have acid added to it in order to be safe for boiling water bath canning. So the rule of thumb is typically that you use bottled lemon juice, and you use a tablespoon of bottled lemon juice for every pint of tomatoes that you're canning.
Sharon, again, do you want to add to that?
You know, it's really, the whole thing is very simple. You really don't have to worry. There's not much that can poison you as long as you're keeping the acidity up. Yeah. And I find that, honestly, lemon juice makes, you know, almost everything taste better. A little acidity contrast to the sweetness of the fruit can be really, really nice. So it's not complicated, and it shouldn't scare people at all. Pressure canning, as, you know, Marisa says, is a somewhat different animal, and you have to be much more careful with that. But even that, I mean, it's riskier to drive a car. You know, as long as you do it correctly, you know, there's very little harm you can do yourself in preserving. You just need to know the rules. I do advise everybody get a book, an actual paper book, not the internet, that has canning, basic canning recipes and rules. And if they have that paper book, because most of us, when our hands are covered with peach juice, are not going to want to run up and use the computer.
So, go ahead.
Oh, it's true. And also just, you know, the internet is full of good information. The internet is full of bad information. And you never know which you've landed on when you're doing a search for something. So I agree with Sharon completely. A book, you know, the Ball Blue Book. There's a really great canning sort of Bible out of the University of Georgia's National Center for Home Food Preservation called So Easy to Preserve, or, you know, my book or Sharon's book. You know, they all have great information.
Indeed. And those, Marisa's book is Food in Jars, and Sharon's book is Independence Days. We have about a minute or so before our first break here, Sharon. I'm just curious about things people should think about with pickling. Is that any different from canning?
Well, there's two kinds of pickling. One of them is vinegar pickling, where you use vinegar to make the pickles, and then often you would can, not always, but often you would can it if you wanted it to last a long time. And that would be just like any other kind of pickle.
Right.
The other kind of pickling is lactofermentation, which is done with bacteria found in nature. And that's a little bit more complicated, and you, that will often last a little longer in a cold place by itself without actually canning and preserving. So pickling's a little bit more complicated, and again, it's one of those things where you'd want a good book to sort of help you work your way through it. But it's not, neither one of those forms is dangerous, it's not risky, and anybody can do it.
Well, let's take that short break. We'll get back to our conversation. We are talking about pickling and canning, preserving, storing food. Talking with Sharon Astick. She's joining us by telephone. She's a writer. She's a teacher, blogger. In fact, she and her family live on a farm in rural upstate New York. And she does have a book called Independence Days. Also with us is Marisa McClellan. She's a writer, a blogger, and the author of a book as well called Food in Jars. And both of them joining us today on Radio Times, getting a sense of, I guess, urban and rural canning and preserving. And taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. Give us a call, 1-888-477-WHYY. We'll be right back.
The Pennsylvania Academy of the Fine Arts supports WHYY. On view now through September 30th, Dive Deep, Eric Fischel and the Process of Painting. Major works by internationally acclaimed artist Eric Fischel, known for his representational work focusing on the American suburban experience and the language of human bodies. For details, 215-972-7600 or pafa.org. pafa.org.
There's a lot of confusion about the hardiness and even basic identity of some culinary herbs. I'm Mike McGrath, and on the next You Bet Your Garden, we'll talk about herbs that are annual and perennial and reveal why the nomenclature can confuse even the experts. Plus answers to all your growing questions. That's You Bet Your Garden, Saturday morning at 11, right here on WHYY-FM.
Rising R&B star Frank Ocean revealed that his first love was another man. And hip-hop mogul Russell Simmons tweeted about Ocean's courage and honesty. Meanwhile, CNN journalist Anderson Cooper confirmed long-standing rumors that he's gay. The cost of coming out in the public eye is the talk of the barbershop. Next time on Tell Me More.
this afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowain. We're talking about canning and pickling and preserving food. And before I get back to our guests here, let's listen to Greg Brown's song called, funnily enough, Canned Goods.
Let the wild winter wind bellow and blow. I'm as warm as a July toe. May toe. Peaches on the shelf, potatoes in the bin. Supper ready, everybody come on and taste a little of the sun. Taste a little of the summer. Taste a little of the summer. Grandma put it all in jars. Well, there's the roots and the fruits and the down below. Watch your head now and down you go. Peaches on the shelf, potatoes in the bin. Supper ready, everybody. Come on in, taste a little of the summer. Taste a little of the summer. Taste a little of the summer. Grandma put it all in jars.
And again, that's Greg Brown's Canned Goods. And we're talking about canning food, fruits and vegetables, with our guests Sharon Astick and Marisa McClellan. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Marisa, let me turn to you. And Sharon, I'd love to have you add to this as well. I just want to put what we're talking about into a little bit of a historic context. I remember, I'm older than you, Marisa, I remember my mother canning things, but it really goes back, 100 years or more?
Well, actually, we have Napoleon to thank for the modern canning process. When he was taking his troops into battle, he needed to find a way to store food more effectively for the troops. So he essentially offered a monetary prize to people to develop a way to store food better and make it last. And so that's where the modern canning process came out of. The mason jar, as we know it today, actually was invented in the U.S. In the 1860s by Mr. Mason, who sadly never made any money off of it. He sold the patent and died a fairly poor man. But it developed, it went on. I think it was a man named Kerr, which, you know, there's a jar named after him, who innovated that the two-piece lid that we use today. And so people have been canning in this country and using mason jars for about 150 years. And so it's a process and a practice that has been around for a long time.
Sharon, anything you want to add?
Well, just that, you know, canning is, I think, the first thing most of us think about when we think about food preservation. But it is worth noting that, you know, before canning, people preserved all the food they needed through winter seasons or dry seasons, you know, for as long as there have been human beings. And that food preservation is one of the most basic things that human beings do. And I think that's one of the reasons we're all so attracted to it is, you know, whether we do it in the most modern way by putting something in a freezer or the most ancient ways by salting or drying things in the sun, we're attracted to this because this is what human beings have been doing as long as we've been human.
Well, in Greg Brown's song, Canned Goods, he talks about the fruit cellar. And I'm curious, Sharon, do you have a root cellar?
I don't have a conventional root cellar. Our basement is very, very wet, and it's not a great place to put fruits and vegetables. What I do have is a partly insulated sun porch that we inherited from my grandparents who used to live with us that we use as a storage mechanism for our produce, which is actually, I think, a really useful thing to be able to tell people is that you don't have to have an official root cellar. What you need is a place that stays cold and doesn't freeze, you know, during the winter. And depending on your climate and where you are, that may or may not be an achievable thing. But we do store an enormous quantity of fresh, really delicious vegetables through the winter, just sitting on that porch covered up with old blankets and things.
Marisa, we're not at the end of the summer when those tomatoes, those Jersey tomatoes that come in or out of people's gardens or CSAs. But do you can tomatoes when you...
I do. I mean, I live in a... I, I live in an apartment on the 20th floor of a high-rise in Center City, so I don't have a ton of space. My kitchen is 80 square feet, but I do still can about 100 pounds of tomatoes every September. I drive either out to Lancaster or New Jersey and pick them up, and you know, they live in my front hall coat closet and in a cabinet in my living room and under a dresser in my bedroom, so I definitely, I do tomatoes, and I love them.
Well, let me get some callers in at 1-888-477-9499. We are talking about preserving, storing, canning, pickling food. And our guests are Marisa McClellan and Sharon Astick. Let's see what Steve from Manioc has to say. And Steve, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
All right. I love the topic.
Good.
Number one, though, I have to disagree with a couple things. First of all, just saying like the steam process, that's not 201, that's 401. When you do low acid, you need a book, a paper book, and you follow it to the T because that can kill you. However, I do a lot of canning. I usually do low acid, I mean, I do high acid or low moisture, right? And these are wonderful, wonderful, wonderful ways to go. But one thing you said about using reusing the jars, you've got to remind people, A, that you need a new flat lid every single time, because that's not saving money, it can hurt you. And the other thing is a quick thing is you put about an ounce to a gallon of bleach and you pre-soak the glass and the lids first, and that knocks down the number one thing, which is mold. And I'll take your comments off the air.
Thank you. Fair enough. Steve, I'm going to start with you, Marisa.
Well, I totally agree that you need to remind people that you need a new lid for every canning project that you do. That is true. We hadn't really gotten to those nitty-gritties yet. And as far as soaking jars in a bleach solution as a way of sterilizing them before canning, I have found it that it's not necessary. Some people like to do it that way. I feel that provided that you do a good, solid water bath process at the end of canning, that that really takes care of your bacteria and mold issues. So, I mean, that's how I've done it for years, and I've never had a mold issue.
And just to pick up on that, and you're talking about once you're done putting the jars back into that that pot and boiling for about 10 minutes.
Yeah. Well, for 10 minutes for jams and jellies, the time varies drastically for different products. So, for instance, if you water bath can your tomatoes, that's typically between a 45 or an 85-minute process, depending on the method that you've used to pack those tomatoes.
Sharon, anything you want to add?
Yeah, I do want to mention that there is such a thing as a reusable canning lid. It's produced by the Tattler Company, and they're fairly new, and a lot of people don't know about them. They are generally regarded as safe, and they can be used for both pressure and water bath canning. And I think it is really important to mention that with pressure canning, you're mentioning something that you are using something that could include botulism and that can kill you. And so, again, you do have to be really very careful about pressure canning. But, again, if you eat canned food from the supermarket, you are eating food that is handled with that process. It's like driving, you know. There are professional drivers, but most of us can drive a car. It's a matter of being careful, cautious, and specific, you know, and making sure you do it really right each time.
And I'm curious, Sharon, when you talk about pressure canning, how does that work?
Pressure canning, well, you know, there are things that are not high acid. They can support botulism, which is an anaerobic bacteria found in soil. Basically, it comes from dirt. It's very hard to, you can't avoid it. So it's one of those things where what you need is a higher temperatures than can be produced by simply boiling. So you need basically to produce a vacuum inside there and to raise temperatures higher than standard boiling. So what you get is you need an actual something called a pressure canner, and you need to follow the directions on it, and it uses extra pressure to basically raise temperatures higher than you could get by simple water boiling.
That sounds more complicated, Marisa.
It is more complicated. I mean, essentially, you're trying to raise the temperature. Botulism spores are killed at around 235 degrees, and you can't get to that at no matter how long you boil something without adding pressure to elevate the temperature. And pressure canners cook up to about 240 degrees, and so they kill off those botulism spores. But the canning process, like the vacuum, is sealed in much the same way as water bath canning.
Well, let's get back to our callers at 1-888-477-9499. If you have any questions about canning, pickling, preserving, storing food, do give us a call. Again, that phone number, 1-888-477-9499. Let me get John from Doylestown to join us. And John, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Morning, ladies.
Morning.
Quite an inspiration. I've
Good.
Canned in the far distant past, and I've been toying with getting rid of all my stuff and giving it to a friend who has a huge garden, and you've inspired me to pull it out, dust it off, and start doing it again.
You got
But I did have a question, one other comment that I think that people, if they check and your lid after the water bath will be sucked down, and if they notice that the lid is popped up, that's a sign that they need to throw that stuff out. And that was one of the things that I think, a tip that might help. The question I had is, there's such a glut of blueberries, and short of making, you know, piles of jam, is there some way to preserve blueberries that you can kind of have them in the blueberry form as opposed to a jam-like form?
Actually, I see Marisa nodding her head. I'll find out if Sharon was nodding her head as well. Go ahead, Marisa.
Yes, I mean, there are a number of ways that you can preserve blueberries. To do them in a whole form, you can can them in a syrup, or you can even can them in like a white grape juice. You just need to preserve them in a way where you have sort of a sweet liquid that they can be packed in. But there are a number of books out there that would have the correct processing time for something like that, where you would just do a syrup or a juice pack.
Give some blueberry ideas, Sharon.
Yeah, I would suggest dehydration. You can do that there. You can actually buy a dehydrator. I see them at cheap ones at garage sales all the time. Or you can actually arrange, you know, it's a little harder in a humid climate to just dry in the sun. You know, if you lived out in California, you could just lay everything out, you know, on a screen and it would just dry. But, you know, there are plants on the web for solar food dryers that work in humid climates. And it's really cool because those dried blueberries can go straight into your breakfast cereal, and they are so good.
And how about freezing? How much do you do that, Sharon?
Absolutely. And freezing is another really good way. And, of course, it's nice and easy. You just have to put them in a plastic bag and get the air out and stick them in the freezer. And that is also another way. I think if you have a limited amount of freezer space and you don't have a big chest freezer, that it can be tough to do a lot of stuff that way. But the nice thing is a couple of small bags of berries don't take up that much space, and you will be so happy to have them in February.
Well, thanks for calling in, John. Let's see what Karen from Reading has to say. And Karen, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi
there.
Thank you for taking my call.
You're very welcome.
I just wanted to say that I am making zucchini bread right now with my glut of zucchinis that I have from my garden. I'm standing here shredding zucchini, thinking, well, this is how I preserve my zucchini pretty much, because I make zucchini bread throughout the summer and freeze it for over the winter.
Marisa?
No,
fair enough. Yeah. We'll let you get back to your dog there. Yeah, go ahead.
That's a great way to preserve zucchini. I also just wanted to throw in that zucchini makes an excellent pickle. If you get tired of zucchini bread, you can pickle it. And I find it actually, it holds its texture really well and is quite delicious as a pickle as well.
And that's Marisa McClellan. She's got a book called Food in Jars, Preserving in Small Batches Year-Round. Also with us is Sharon Astick, and she's got a book called Independence Day, A Guide to Sustainable Food Storage and Preservation, our topic for today's Radio Times. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. Let me get Andy from Nazareth to join us. And Andy, go ahead. You're on the air.
Yes, hi. Thank you very much for taking my call.
You're very welcome.
Years past, I've made spaghetti sauce with my tomatoes in my garden, and also a mixture of canned sauces and paste as well. And last year, I made a bolognese sauce with ground beef and sausage and all. And I used the boiled jar method to preserve it, and it came out pretty good. But I was left asking myself, really, is that the best way to preserve a meat sauce?
Well, let me turn that to Sharon first, although Marisa is saying no. But go ahead, Sharon. Let me give you a first whack at that.
Yeah, that's a big no, unfortunately. And I'm glad that you're, you know, happy and healthy and here to tell us about it. But the problem is that when you add low-acid vegetables or meat to tomatoes, it changes the acidity so that you simply can't boiling water, can't bath can it safely. And, you know, the reality of botulism, which is, you know, just highly deadly, is that you can't be sure. You know, there might not be any botulism in your jars, but it's just not worth playing Russian roulette with it. So what I would say is that if you're going to make meat sauce, you know, freeze it, or you learn to use a pressure canner and do the pressure canning correctly. Because whenever I hear these things, I think, oh no, please, we don't. None of us want to kill our family and friends making tomato sauce because that's just not worth it.
Indeed, or add it to, you know, add it at when you're actually cooking your sauce. Anything you want to add to that, Marisa?
No, Sharon had covered it all.
You had this stricken look on your face, yes, Andy. So, Andy, if you have any of those jars left over, I would say toss them, right?
Absolutely.
Or certainly get rid of what's inside. Let me see what Bridget from Douglasville has to say. Bridget, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi.
Hi there.
I'm calling because I wanted to ask a question about Marisa's Bing and red wine syrup recipe.
Mm-hmm.
I made that, and the jars didn't seal right away, and I put it, I put it back in the water bath, and I was just wondering if that was okay to do, or should I just scrap the stuff, the recipe that's in there, and make it again?
Let's find out. Go ahead.
They should be fine. It could be that during the initial canning process, there were some air bubbles trapped in the cherries, and so they pushed a little bit of brine out of the liquid out of the jars, which could have interfered with the seal. But as long as they're sealed now, that's a high acid product between the cherries and the wine, so there's no safety hazard. So if they're sealed and you're happy with the quality of them, they should be just fine.
Thanks for calling in, Bridget. Marisa, do you have a favorite recipe?
I have many favorite recipes, but this time of year, one of my favorites is dilly beans, pickled green beans, because a lot of times it's hard to get a really crunchy pickle out of a preserved pickle. Cucumbers get a little soggy during the boiling water bath process, but green beans just stay crisp and so pickly. They're phenomenal.
How about for you, Sharon?
Oh, that's a tough one, but right now we're watching my apricots, you know, ready to ripen here, and I think I make a real reduced apricot lemon jam that is one of my favorite things all winter long.
And are your children, you mentioned the fact you have about six children there. Do they get involved in the canning preserving process?
They do, actually. They're fine pickers. We go out and, you know, we harvest large quantities of things both from our garden and from local pick-your-own farms for fruits that I don't grow, and they are big on that, and then they are wonderful corn huskers. We we make corn relish, and we freeze some corn all year, and my kids are the ones who take a great deal of pride in husking, you know, a lot of corn at a time, and, you know, so they've been really helpful. My oldest son is now at the point where I'm letting him help water bath can. He's 10. But it does require, you know, an attentiveness, and there are knives, and things get slippery and greasy, so for the younger kids, they're mostly peelers and huskers and pickers.
Well, let's take another short break. We'll get back to our conversation. We're talking about canning and preserving and pickling food. Talking with Sharon Astick. She's a writer, a teacher, a blogger. She's a farmer in upstate New York. As she describes, she and her family living on a 27-acre homestead, and they raise vegetables. They also pasture poultry and dairy goats. She wrote a book called Independence Days. Also with us is Marisa McClellan, and she's a writer, a canner, and she has a blog called Food in Jars and a book called Food in Jars, and she teaches canning classes in and around Philadelphia, including one tomorrow at Greensgrove Farm in Kensington, and we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. Just one or two open lines at 1-888-477-WHYY. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
I'm Ray Suarez. Coming up on America Abroad.
I said, who are the smartest guys you have who want to work on developing something that will pump water from sunshine?
Global demand for water is increasing along with the world's population, and sanitation is an issue in many places, making water management a crucial issue. The Global Water Challenge, next on America Abroad from Public Radio International.
Tonight at 11 on WHYY.
On the next Fresh Air, James Murphy, founder of the dance indie rock band LCD Sound System. The new film, Shut Up and Play the Hits, documents LCD Sound System's farewell concert last year at Madison Square Garden. Join us.
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
Hi, I'm Robin Young. Join us next time for the news and these stories here and now. Why are so many black bears showing up within city limits? Wildlife officials say get used to it. Also, the old 97's Rhett Miller goes solo again, his killer combo of country rock and power pop on his new CD. That's Public Radio's Daily Digest of News and Culture here and now.
Today at noon on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowain. We're talking about the fact that canning and preserving, pickling, they're making a comeback. Many people are growing their own food. They're supporting local farms, and they actually want to enjoy all that food year-round. And for others, it's about health and being self-sufficient and reducing their energy footprint. We're talking about all of this with Sharon Astick and Marisa McClellan, and we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. Let me get Ed from media to join us. Ed, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi. I was wondering, is a no-cook freezer jam as safe as the canning method, as far as storing things for a one-year time frame?
And you said no-cook jam.
Yes.
Is that what you said?
Yes. One of the companies that sells the pectin. And the jars.
Okay.
I know what you're talking about. Do you mean, is it safe to can, like boiling water bath process freezer jam?
Well, this is a completely no cook, you know.
No. Okay. I know what you're talking about.
Ahead,
so it's
Marisa.
The freezer jam where essentially you take mashed fruit and add sugar and the freezer jam pectin and stir it together, put it in containers, and pop it in the freezer. And that's perfectly safe and fine to preserve for a year or sometimes more, as long as it doesn't degrade in quality and doesn't get freezer burnt.
But the idea is it goes directly into the freezer.
Yes, it goes right into the freezer.
Do you do that, Sharon?
I don't actually. I save my freezer for things generally that that I feel are really better quality when they're frozen. Honestly, I think that for me, the things that are best quality when they're frozen tend to be meat. There are some vegetables that really shouldn't be canned and things because of the quality degrades. Mm. Whereas I tend to think jams and jellies are just as good when they're preserved, and this allows me to keep room in my freezer for other stuff. But there's nothing wrong with it. It's just a matter of limited freezer space.
And I'm curious, what kind of food do you think just doesn't work so well with canning?
Well, any brassica vegetable, which are your cabbages, your broccoli, those kinds of vegetables, those don't usually can well. They don't get a good flavor. So if you want to eat broccoli in February and you don't want to get it from far away, usually that we blanch and freeze that because, it's one of those things that does not, by the time you process it for as long as you would have to in a pressure canner, it's mush.
Yeah. And Sharon, you're in upstate New York. Do you grow year-round? Do you grow food year-round?
We do. I mean, I don't have a greenhouse, so we're somewhat limited in what we can produce, but we do have some food growing in the house all year round and some stuff in the garden that's protected and sheltered. And depending on the winter, this past winter was so mild, we kept everything going all year. Some winters when it's really cold, we don't have much in January and February, but we do most of the rest of the year.
And are you canning every day now?
We're just starting the food preservation. It's a little cooler here than it is there, and our season is a little later. We're up fairly high up, so the pickles are just coming, the cucumbers are just coming in enough to start pickling and things like that. So the blueberries are just coming. We started with the strawberries, and the big high rush will be towards the end of this month and then going into August and September.
Sort of a around-the-clock operation. And Marisa, I mean, you live in an apartment in Center City, Philadelphia.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of different from Sharon.
It's very different. I tend to get my produce from farmers markets, or over the years that I've been doing this, I've made friends with a lot of farmers, so they hook me up with their seconds. But definitely, I've been canning some, although I've been traveling promoting the book, so I'm promoting a book about canning and not actually doing a lot of canning right at the moment.
Yes, that happens. Yeah. That happens. Let me get Esther from Center City, Philadelphia to join us. And Esther, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hello.
Hi there.
Hi. I've been canning according to the Ball Blue book, and one of the things that it says is that I sterilize my jars, but then it says to pack them into dry jars to pack the food into dry jars. Now, that means that I don't take it right directly out of the hot water and pack it, because there'd be water in,
well,
you know, in the jar, and I don't understand. What I do is I just turn them upside down on clean towels.
Right.
Esther, and let them dry.
Well, let me see what Marie says.
Typically, if you have boiled your jars, the water is so hot that when you take them out of the canner and empty them out, it evaporates pretty quickly. So as long as you've given them a minute or two to sit and evaporate, mm-hmm. that's plenty. You don't have to do too much to actually dry them.
Esther, thanks for calling into Radio Times. You can call as well. And that phone number is 1-888-477-9499. Sherilyn, let me go back to you. And I mentioned the fact that some people are interested in the kind of food preservation that you do because they want to reduce their energy footprint. Have you been able to do that?
My family lives on about 20% of the energy resources that the average American household does. And my family size is 8, not 2.6, which is, I think, what the national average is. So, yes, we have managed to make some pretty significant changes. And a large part of that has been, you know, taking advantage of food when there's large quantities of local food. It's cheap, it's available, you know, and farmers need to get rid of it just like we need to fill it up. And taking advantage of that and really buying what we have that's here and eating that all year round. And that's been a big help.
And buying a lot in bulk, I would think, too.
Yeah, exactly. And, I mean, what I find is, and I think that if you live in a city and you go to the farmer's market, you'll sometimes be, you know, well, I paid, you know, $7 for 4 tomatoes. But what you may not know is that if you talk to those farmers, you could get a bushel of tomatoes for, you know, maybe $30, you know, and you'd be getting much better per pound deal. I think a lot of people don't really know that a lot of produce is available in bulk through farmers if you ask.
Mm-hmm. And from your relationship with farmers?
Oh, absolutely. And also there are, you know, like Greensgrove, the farm, you know, I'm doing this signing all day tomorrow with them 10 to 2 and then at class, and they actually offer deals for canners. So you can contact them, and whatever that's in season right now, they'll sell you a flat or, you know, a half bushel or whatever volume you want at a discount. So there are ways in Philadelphia, even if you live in the city, to get those same sort of farmer discounts.
Let me see what Tony from Germantown has to say. And Tony, go ahead, you're on Radio Times.
How are you doing?
Good,
one of my concerns is I'm a diabetic, and most of the recipes I see for jams and jellies have a lot of sugar in them.
Yeah.
Are there any non-sugar recipes, and how do they perform, I guess?
Well, Tony, let me see what Marisa says.
Well, unfortunately, traditional jams are dependent on sugar because they rely on sugar for their set, because when you heat sugar up to a certain temperature, it has a chemical reaction. However, there are a number of really good pectins out there that you can get that allow you to make jams with either like stevia or a sugar alternative, or small amounts of honey. Pomona's pectin is one. And then I know that both Ball and Mrs. Wages both make a low sugar and no sugar pectin. So there are ways to do it. It's never going to be the same as the traditional sugar to jam. It gets a little bit firmer. It's not as sweet, obviously, but it's a really good alternative if you can't have sugar.
Do you have any suggestions, Sharon?
Yeah, I think what you're mostly looking for are those low methyl pectins is the term, and there are several different brands. And then you'll probably want to experiment a little bit. You know, there are different sweeteners give you different flavors. Mm-hmm. And there are a lot of recipes out there on the Internet to play around with. And you'll just want to see which one tastes best to you.
Well, it sounds like you need sweeteners and some acid as well. Mm-hmm. Is that right, Marisa?
Well, most fruits that you're going to make jam out of have enough acid to be safe. But you always want to add a little lemon juice for the balance of flavor, I find. So, you know, it never hurts to add a little lemon or lime juice.
Good luck, Tony. And thanks for calling into Radio Times to see what, Julie from Elkins Park has to say. And Julie, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi.
Hi.
Thanks for having me.
You're welcome.
When I was growing up, I worked in a community garden, and I'm the oldest of 6 kids, so whatever was available from the garden was brought home to my family. And my mother and I did a lot of cooking. She got everybody canning and preserving. She got everybody involved. And to me, that's one of the best memories of having spent time with my mother. And I just, wanted to pass that along in terms of, community and nurturing and values. Also, I had a question, which is I'd like to, I understand there's a bunch of, there are places where you can go and swap your goods with other people. And I don't know any right now because I'm new to the area, but I thought, well, that would be kind of cool, but how do you know what's safe or who, you know, what do you ask people to know that they prepared their stuff right?
Well, you called the right place. Julie, go ahead, Marisa.
I actually do help coordinate the Philly Food Swappers group, and so the best way to find it if you want to join us and swap some homemade food is through the Facebook page. If you search for Philly Food Swappers on Facebook, you'll find it. And then as far as how to know if something is safe, typically people, you know, you can ask them about their practices, and often the things that people are bringing, there are canned goods, but there are also things like granolas or cookies or things like that. And typically with those high-acid foods like the jams and the pickles, you can feel fairly confident that what you're going to get is going to be safe. And if you're at all concerned, you can ask the person.
Again, Sharon, anything you want to add to that?
Well, just that community part of this is really important. And I think it's one of those things where it's easy to envision yourself standing over a hot stove for days basing this. It gets a lot more fun when you get together with your friends and say, okay, we're going to go blueberry picking, and then we're going to get together and we're going to make the blueberry jam and the chutney together and then split the jars together. So I think a lot of those cooperative community things are just a lot of fun.
Including parties, right, Marisa?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I love the canning party. I'm actually doing a kind of a party class with Blooming Glen Farm out in Percocet later in August, where we're going to do like a ton of tomatoes. We're all going to get together, and there's spots available in that class if anybody wants to join us.
Your book also includes foods in jars mixes, where they're dry foods, I guess, that, that are mixed together in a jar.
Yeah, there's some baking mixes and things like that.
Let me see what looks like Diane has to say. Diane, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Yes, thank you for taking my call.
You're welcome.
I am a lover of soft fruit like berries, strawberries, blueberries, raspberries, etc. And I have, I don't know if somebody else developed, but I do it a little differently because I like my fruit when I defrost it to be whole.
Right.
And what I do is spread the raspberry, for example, in a single layer on cookie sheets. And then I freeze it, and it takes, for raspberries, it takes about 40 minutes. For blackberries, it takes about an hour. Then I pack them in a plastic bags, double plastic bag, and I add 2 tablespoonfuls of sugar. And then when I throw it out in the wintertime, the fruit looks exactly like I put it in the freezer. It looks fresh. It doesn't taste fresh. It would taste frozen, but it holds nice shape, so you can put it on cakes.
Sounds good.
Yeah.
Sounds good. Diane, let me see if Sharon wants to add anything to that.
Mm-hmm.
Sharon?
I think it's a great idea, and I think that beauty is really wonderful in the winter. You know, it's nice to be able to have a little bit of fruit that looks just perfect to use as the topping to things and things. That makes everybody, I think, feel like spring might someday come. Mm-hmm.
Let me squeeze one. Diane, thanks for calling. We have one more caller. This is Phoebe from Lancaster. And Phoebe, we're almost out of time, but go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi. Hey. I have a quick question for Marisa. I'm out here in Lancaster County, and we have farm fresh eggs everywhere. And I love that I can use the egg yolk after I use the whites. But do you have any tips on canning versus freezing to make citrus curds that I can gift at the holiday season?
Well, curds, yes. As far as those citrus curds go, you mean like freezing the yolks to use to make the curd later on?
Is that something I could do as well?
You could, or actually curds do freeze really well. They hold better as a frozen product than they do as a canned product, so you could have a marathon curd freezing.
Oh, wow.
Or a curd making day, and do it in either those little 4-ounce jars or the wide mouth 8-ounce jars, and freeze them and then just defrost them and give them away for the holidays.
Does that sound doable, Phoebe?
That sounds wonderful.
Fair enough. Thanks for calling into Radio Times. And Sharon, it's pretty hot down here in Philadelphia. Are you looking for a good growing season this year?
Yeah, I think it is. I mean, it's a little dry, so things are a little stunted, you know, up near us. But and it's certainly a little hot, but that does mean that we're already eating the first tomatoes, and I can see the day when I'll have enough tomatoes to be canning.
Right. And is there a recipe, Marisa, a recipe that you haven't developed yet that you're interested in developing?
I guess this summer I'm really looking towards even smaller batches because I live in an apartment. I'm always trying to have the space to be creative and try new things and keep those batches as small as possible so I can have the most breadth.
Well, on that note, my thanks to both of you. Marisa, thank you for joining us today on Radio Times. Marisa McClellan's book is called Food in Jars. And Sharon, thank you for joining us as well.
Thanks so much for having us.
You're welcome. And Sharon Asick's book is called Independence Days. Kevin Griffin, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times. Our interns are Jared Brausch and Michaela Cross. Susan Greenbaum, Patty McMahon, Dennis Devine, and Debbie Builder produce Radio Times. For more information about the program, you can go to whyy.org/Radio Times. I'm Marty Moscoane. Thank you so much for joining us. And we do want to close things out with another food song. And this is Guy Clark's song called Homegrown Tomatoes.
There ain't nothing in the world that I like better than bacon and lettuce and homegrown tomatoes. Up in the morning, out in the garden, get you ripe when you don't get a hard one. Plant them in the spring, eat them in the summer. All winter without them's a culinary bummer. I forget all about the sweating and digging every time I go out and pick me a bit. Homegrown tomatoes, homegrown tomatoes. What'd life be without homegrown tomatoes? Only two things that money can't buy, and that's true love and homegrown tomatoes. Well, you can go out to eat, and that's for sure, but it's nothing a homegrown tomato won't cure. Put them in a salad, put them in a stew. You can make your very own tomato juice. You can eat them with eggs. You can eat them with gravy. Eat them with beans, pinto or navy. Put them on a side. Put them in the middle. Put a homegrown tomato on a hot cake griddle.
Homegrown tomatoes, homegrown tomatoes. What'd life be without homegrown tomatoes? Only two things that money can't buy, and that's true love and homegrown tomatoes.